So, Becca, today we're going to chat about your lovely mom, Marie, who was very much the impetus, I think, for us coming together to do this archive. A Greenham woman herself, and I myself remember hearing you talk about her in so many different feminist ways and political ways across the years. And also, obviously, having met her many times myself, I was always just really aware of how impressive and really kind of mentally astute, and yeah, what a wonderful woman she was. So I'm really excited to be chatting about her and feel really happy that we're going to get her in the archive and her stories in the archive. So did you want, should we start talking about how your mum, what your sort of mum's early political journeys, how she came to be so political and such a force for good in the world?
Yeah, sure. I think that it's interesting her journey because she's basically, I think that the Greenham was a big part of it comes at a time where she's suddenly becoming more politically aware. She's drawn to it for those reasons, but it also becomes a kind of massive bump forward and a fast forward in her journey to being a truly political person. Because at the beginning of my mum's life is she grows up on a very nice but a council estate. You always say, whenever I say she grew up on a council estate in Sheffield, it always sounds like I'm saying like she had this tragic start, and she didn't at all. It was a very, very nice council estate, but she was the only girl with four. I got four or five uncles. I think I've got four uncles, and she's they're a big group of blokes, and a dad who'd had been a very loving dad, I think, for the first part of her life, and then had become a very withdrawn, depressed man after an accident on a building site where he worked. He had a head injury, and so for lots of reasons, became very introverted, very, very difficult dad. And she just grew up, and she grew up, in the 50s and 60s when and so I think her awareness of like trying to get her voice heard in a very masculine northern environment in a group in a family of mainly men, sort of predisposed her, I think, to feminism. And she definitely and she took she was already taking kind of unconventional actions. So she did the she got married to her like an early boyfriend who was great mates with her brothers and things like that. And then when she met my dad, and was going to, and left her first husband for my dad. There was a lot of like, you can't do that. We all play golf with him and he's a mate, and what would Trevor do and things. And she had to keep doing these things that were kind of swimming upstream all the time. And I remember her telling me all the time about how when she was young, she was very smart, but she was also a woman and working class. So people were like, well, you can either be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher. And so she to train to, she sort of thought, well, I don't want to be a nurse, and no one's telling me I'm clever enough to be a teacher, and we haven't really got the funds for me to go and do that sort of stuff, so I'll train to be a secretary. And then she ended up doing things like being the secretary for the students' union in Sheffield, and having an affair with the student union officer, who was an Indian student. So she was doing all these kind of like quite racy things. And then her husband would find out, and she'd stop doing it until my dad. And then she was like, "No, I actually don't want to be with you, and I want to be with this guy." So she's kind of like making these kind of like quite bold decisions, but within the construct of a more kind of like perhaps a less consciously political life.
How old was she when she met your dad then?
So she must have been in her mid 20s, I think. Early to mid 20s, maybe only early, because she must have got married quite young, because they had me when so she must be mid 20s, because they had me for a couple of years and then they got married, and I think she was about 28, 29 when they had me and got married. But that I think I'd been around for a couple of years by then. So they're
It's sort of mid-70s.
mid 70s. She gets married in a really great floral, very 70s. My dad's got long hair. She's in a floral dress. It's a very unconventional looking little wedding. But apparently, I escaped from the creche and ran down the aisle and had to be held in the register office that they could get married, because they didn't want them to get married without me. Stuff like that. So I think that she, when she meets my dad, they then kind of have a real meeting of minds about things like they both don't want to send me to school, for example. They decide to home educate. And again, all of their families are like, but that's bonkers, you know. Even the primary school I was at was all like, oh, she's a clever girl, she could have gone to university, you're gonna ruin her life. And their families were all really down on it. And my mum was just very good at going, no, I think it just feels like the right thing to do. And if it isn't the right thing to do, we won't do it. We'll do something else. We'll change our minds. And I can remember them actually talking to me about whether I wanted to be deschooled or not. And me going, what does that mean? And them going, oh, good point. Okay, what it means is that you wouldn't go to school anymore. We do what you do your work at home. And we how would you keep with your friends? And this is what we do. We'd have these different people around. And we'd have clubs. And I was like, does it mean I don't have to get up early in the morning and go to school? And like, basically, does it mean I don't have to get up early? And they were like, yeah, you can get up wherever you want. And I was like, I'm in. So like, there were quite bold decisions that went completely against like the norm, I think, that she was very, she just had this weird core of kind of self-confidence, even though really, in a lot of ways, I don't know where she got that from. I guess, I never met her mum, but I think she was a strong woman. I think one time there was a threat of, I hate to say this, because I knew my granddad and he was lovely by the time I met him. He was an old man living with us and he was just lovely. He was on different medication. He was dead nice. My mum sorted that out as well, actually. Took him to a really good doctor and they were like, he's on depressants. Why has he been on depressants for like 40 years? Let's give him some antidepressants. And then I have this memory of a really lovely granddad. But originally, I think there were times when after he'd had his accidents where he was not lovely and maybe even there was a threat of violence, definitely at one point, because my mum can remember her mum jumping up from the kitchen table and grabbing the poker and saying to him, I think he'd threatened, like raised his hand to her, I think. And she just said to him, come on then, you bastard, sort of threatening him with the poker. So I think my mum got a lot of like full on kind of like northern eggs from her mum, who I never got to meet. She died quite suddenly of a kind of brain hemorrhage, so I don't, that's the impression I get. But so maybe there was this kind of like just this confidence in the two of them, and maybe she'd seen that in her own mum. But they definitely, like, I can remember my uncles, again, who I'm very fond of, but I can remember them putting my mum down. And she remembers as she was growing up, it was just constantly like being put down for being a mouthy girl and being bossy or being lippy and yet somehow she just had this real confidence in her own decisions. Really, really like super confident about her own decision-making process, to the point that, like, if you fast forward, to the point where we lived near Greenham, and then we'd moved to Cornwall, and my mum hadn't been involved in any more kind of particular activism for probably quite a few years. She'd had my brother, and she'd been like full-time being a mum, and then she'd gone into being a relate counsellor and sort of retrained and done all this sort of stuff. And we went on it was right around the protest against the Iraq war. And we went on, for the first time in years, went on a peace march together. And it was through the countryside, through the kind of...
When was this? Was this after Greenham?
Yeah, this is way after Greenham. This is like, this is her when she's quite... This is a woman, she's quite shy. She wouldn't, like, things like, if we were out in public, she'd want me to go to the bathroom with her and things like that, if we were at a cafe or something. She'd always send my dad to pay. She didn't have to talk to, like, strangers very much at all. But she just, this quiet self-confidence that she had... She was now mother of two. I was in my late, I'd put in my early 20s, I think, by this time. And we went on this march. Is that right for the Iraq? Well, yeah, it would have been. And there's only about 100 people. And we went past quite a lot of different RAF and naval bases down here. So we went round the countryside round a base. And she was quite annoyed. There was only about 100 people, and lots of it was women and kids, and lots of lovely banners and people flying different things they'd made, little ribbons and things like that. And it was really nice. But the guys that were kind of had put themselves in charge of it, one of them had a loudspeaker, and the other one, they're both just kind of taking it in turns to do like quite a lot of chanting and rallying. And the whole vibe of this 100 people was really not that. It was really gentle. It was really kind of like not, it wasn't that timbre. So she was already a little bit kind of like, they're not respecting the vibe of the people that are here on this march. And I was like, well, they probably organized it and they probably have an idea of what they want. And she's like, well, that's not how what does that make? So they're just quietly muttering away to me as she's walking along. And we'd never have done this way at Greenham, and there should be a woman on that. Maybe someone should take that megaphone off those silly young boys. And it was a mixture of, and then a guy came and did a poem. We went to the front of this march. The march went to the front of the RAF base, and a really old doddery, like not doddery, it wasn't doddery at all. He was very forceful, but he was really like, he just was old fashioned. He was just old fashioned, probably her age, but he just felt so, oh God. And he read the most appalling poem that he'd written himself to try and dissuade the dogs of war from their actions. And she was like mortified and embarrassed by that as well. She's like, oh my God, why? She's like, there's mostly women and children here. Why are men doing these embarrassing things? And we're such a small group. How has this happened? And then we basically went around the corner to a little green, a little sort of verge to have a final sort of moment. And one of the guys who'd been on the megaphone the whole time said, right, this has been great, you know, it's very important, we've had our say, and there's children playing everywhere, and there's all these different people of different nationalities and things, and they said, so finish off today, I'm going to ask Reverend whoever to come forward, and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer. And that was it. My mum's like, that was, I know, my mum was just, and there was this moment where like every right thinking person in like on this verge, my dad and me, all just like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing and wrong. And like, it was just like, that's the most inappropriate thing. Why would we do that? You know, patriarchy, and we're going to go and bomb a country full of people who aren't Christians, and you know, and people are using the word crusade, literally. Like, all this is flashing through my mind at this time. But in the time it takes for us to just stand there frozen, my mum, who wouldn't go to the loo on her own if we're in a cafe, just stood forward in front of 100 people and just said to this guy, oh no, no, we're not doing that. That's not that. That would be wildly inappropriate, because this is a multi-faith a group of people, and we're trying to look at what unites humanity and not what divides it. And this war is an assault on a lot of cultural levels. I don't think our Christian prayer is an appropriate thing to finish on. I think what we'll do is we'll just have a minute's silence. Thank you, everybody.
And did everyone just see that?
And everyone just went, this is palpable relief. And everyone just went, yeah, total silence. And there was total silence. These guys with the megaphones were just like, what? And just stood there like, and then she counted, mm-hmm. She obviously kept a minute in her head. And then she went, thank you, everybody. That was lovely.
That's hilarious. So many Greenham women said that to us, didn't they? That they weren't necessarily particularly confident people when they went to Greenham, but when they came out, they just had all these random skills, and one of them just happened to be standing up in front of loads of people and just saying, I think we should do this. And you know, what an incredible gift to get from something like that, you know.
Absolutely.
The more practice that you give to your voice, you know, the bolder you get.
Yeah, it, when you really need it, it's there.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, and my mum, you know, she wasn't one of the Greenham women that lived at the camp. We'll probably talk more about, I know, about how what she could do, but even just being around the camp for the time that she was, and in the ways that she was, and the fact that I think being in that women only space and watching how they were organizing and how they, what they were doing, what permissions they were giving each other, that even that much of that gave her that much confidence for the rest of her life. So you can see in a way why Greenham was such a threatening thing, and why it's almost like it's being repealed, you know, its place in history has been, well, it hasn't been awarded one, and so on, and that I think there is, because it properly changed women.
Yeah.
And they never went back.
So in 1981 then, when it was starting, where was your mom in the world, and what was she doing, and what led her to go?
So she and my dad had got together, and they'd had me, and they'd got married, and they'd just moved. They're both from Sheffield, and all their families were in Sheffield, but they'd just moved. He'd got a job, he's in advertising, and he'd got a job in Camberley. So they were doing things like, they just started to home educate me. So they were doing these quite broad, they'd become vegetarian, which again, people just weren't, there wasn't that much of that around then, you know, it was quite unusual, especially they both were kind of lower middle and working class backgrounds, but he got quite a good job by then, and they were having quite a comfortable life. They were living in a,
and she was probably about 30, was she, or late 20s?
Yeah, she would have been like late 20s, early 30s. And they were in this very middle class area, which was nearly all military. They were all officers and in their lovely houses, or retired colonels and things like that. And there was a lot of, it wasn't very friendly. And there were a lot of quite stuffy men around. And then my family, who had like a garden full of ducks and rabbits and rescued animals and children that weren't at school. And like, it was just a really weird sort of mismatch in the area. But that was fine. And basically, that sort of coincided. So my parents are becoming, like I said, this kind of meeting of minds. They're pushing each other to become more, I would say, more compassionate, you know, and more outward looking. So that whole thing about embracing things like vegetarianism and home education, and they're just looking for alternative ways that one might live, I suppose. Which does go along with my mum, I think, being more argumentative. Dad's got memories of lots of dinner parties where she just falls out with people and has massive rows. But then you go back to that yourself at that age and think, well, I was having massive political arguments with people at that age as well, you know, that's what you do. But he remembers it as being pretty stressful. He's not very confrontational, my dad, anyway. And my mum could be very confrontational. So at that time they've moved to Camberley, and nationally there's this absolutely visceral, we're coming to, like, we're right in the height of the Cold War, and we've come into the whole kind of protect and survive kind of leaflets are being sent out. Margaret Thatcher is saying, yeah, come and have your planes here and start your war here, and we'll all die there. That'd be great, Ronnie, and all that stuff. And so there's like a whole, like, you know, there's a whole, there's basically there's this, like a lot of the green women say, there's just this natural national fear, really visceral fear about actually having a nuclear war. And my mum, again, like a lot of, definitely not all the green women, certainly not most of the women that pre-lived at camp, but for a lot of the women that were visitors and supporters, she was definitely brought there by a fear of being a new mother, and she'd really wanted me, you know, she'd really like researched me, you know, she was really a committed, like read all the books, was really trying to be the best mum ever. And the idea that there would be, like, we would all just die in a nuclear war, I think she just, it was like that, all of that fear and that anxiety, and it felt really like governments around the world were stupid enough to let that happen. Hard to imagine now,
yeah,
but they're also smart.
But a lot of women said that, I think, that the government were sort of take responsibility for your children, and some of the green women were very much like, well, this is, I am doing, by stopping a nuclear war, they expect me to sort of feed my child and prevent my child from getting chicken pox, but they don't expect me to stop a nuclear war happening. You know, it was that sort of disconnect from what it is to bring life into the world, to then live in a world that is going to end it very suddenly from nowhere, you know, in the most appalling, brutal way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so she, I think, now this is why I'm a bit fuzzy, because so she basically joined or started, and I don't know which it is, but she became a big part of the local CND for Camberley. So like lots of other people, she joined her local CND as a way of going, the hell can I do about this madness and the bomb and things? So she joins that. And then what I don't know is, I think it existed, and she was a really big part. She became its secretary, and she became a really prominent force within that CND in the way that it was. She was very, other people that went to it at that time have this memory of her running it almost like a mini Greenham, like no one was in charge, but everyone had responsibility, and it was very lateral. My friends the women that I'm friends with, who are her friends from the time, talk about going to their first CND meeting and there being a woman there with a man next to her, and then when they arrived, she was talking and explaining things, and then meeting Colin, her friend said that she just kept thinking, at some point this woman is going to have to hand over to the man to run the meeting. Though, when will the meeting start? When will the man start running the meeting? And then it turned out that the man was never going to take over, and it was always going to be this woman chairing this meeting, and that blew, like, this woman who was there, blew her mind. And she then became really close. And of course, that was my mum and my dad, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, and lots of people from that time in that CND group talk about my mum and dad, like this, as a relationship, they'd just never seen anything like it. He always deferred to her in the room. He always let her run the meetings. But like, she just run the meetings, and and everyone would have got a say in the meetings, and he would be like, I'll go make the tea, or I've brought some sandwiches along, or I'm going to go and just look after Becca, who's in the creche, you know, or whatever. It's my turn at the creche. And this idea that they'd just never seen a relationship. I think they'd never seen a relationship like that. most people at that time. And people all through my childhood always talked about my mum and dad as being this really...
Yeah, they were always like that, weren't they?
Yeah. And people really struggled with it, actually. My mum had a really quite a hard time where people, all her life, I can remember people always saying to her, "You're so lucky, you know. Do you know how lucky you are to have a man like that?" Yeah. And she'd be like, "He's very lucky as well." There was always sort of a threat that she should be basically working harder and being nicer because he was so nice. It's like, no, this is working like this because this is how it works. Because this is perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's letting women get stuff done. So I think that she came to that CND with those kind of principles, but then they also got Greenham women. They obviously, Cambly's really near to Greenham. It's another one of those little satellite, kind of posh counties around that circle that area, one of the home counties kind of areas. It's a town in one of those areas. She started to be very keen to facilitate the camp, to fundraise and to put processes in and be one of the groups that was actively supported, which a lot of local CNDs did, because national CND weren't very keen on the Green Women at the beginning at all. So they didn't get any support from there. So she was doing a lot of that stuff, which a lot of other women in their CND groups doing around the country. And I can remember being at workshops where they'd got Green Women in to teach them NVDA, to teach them how to behave, how to conduct, use NVDA for demos and things. And I can remember them doing a whole... Because these meetings they'd have, they would always be in this little hall, I guess. I don't know where it was, but I would quite often be kicking around, watching and waiting and listening. And I can remember, there'd be stalls and I'd go and look at what was at the little stalls. And one time I found When the Wind Blows by Raymond Briggs. And then I was like in tears for a week. So there was quite traumatic things like that. So like, God, she's found that graphic novel. Oh no, I was only about five. But I can also remember watching them all do this training where they basically sort of created a kind of improvisation about being charged by police horses and dragged off and arrested by police, and how you would use your body with NVDA and how you would go heavy and how you would have a witness and protect people and all that sort of thing. And then they cried. I remember them crying and hugging each other because they got really emotional about it. They got really frightened and they realised that it was going to be a frightening thing that might happen.
And how did you feel watching that? What was in your mind when you were so young watching that?
Well, that one, I remember being fascinated. Absolutely, I can see now them playing out the different parts and how real it seemed. It didn't seem like talking about it sounds like it might look silly, but it didn't at all. It was really well done at the time. I don't know, and I was only little, but it felt really like, oh wow, that would what it would be like. And then when they cried, but I sort of felt like it was safe because their grown-ups were pretending something. Yeah. And then when they cried and were kind of hugging each other, then I was like, oh, maybe it's not okay. And I remember running in and being like, oh, are we cool? Grown ups, what's going on? And then being like, oh, and that, but it was always a bit like that because they were really honest with me about the concepts that we were dealing with and why it was important. But they were also lovely to me and really valued my voice and listened to my little emotions and took everything very seriously for me. Like, I can remember flyering in town, I really wanted to help flyer because the world's beautiful and amazing. We mustn't let it be destroyed by bombs. And I don't want to die. I want everyone I know and love to die, and all my pets and my beloved rescued animals and all my teddies. So I was very I was a very passionate little girl about this stuff. So it seemed completely logical to me that we would all do our part. And I also had that child logic of if you explain it to somebody, it will make complete sense to them, and then we'll be able to sort it out. Mm. But if you go up to tell somebody at a party that they shouldn't probably smoke because they seem really nice, and what they don't realise is that smoking can give them cancer, they'll stop smoking and you've saved their life. And I was doing a lot of that sort of stuff, which my mum and dad were lovely about and did try and sort of mitigate me totally harassing people at parties, but were also like, that's her little personality and she feels things strongly and we want her to care about what happens to other people. And
so, I actually really remember sitting around your kitchen table about 10 or 15 years ago and we were looking at old photographs, I think. And there was one of you, I think there was one of that day when you were flyering, maybe, I don't know whether it was that day because you probably did it more often, but you and your mum were flyering for CND. Oh. Yeah, it was a lovely picture. I remember seeing that, yeah.
That was really nice. Unusually, people were just quite refine about a little girl for helping the flyer ring. Like most people would just be like, and actually quite likely to take a flyer off you for a little girl, you know, like a little child, and you're not being an arse or anything, you're just like handing out flyers. But I remember the one guy being really furious with us one day, really angry with me, and being and like basically holding me to account and being like, you know how to making me basically trying to make me tell him why the nuclear was such a bad idea, and you know what on earth did I know about it anyway, and me like feeling like I had to like bring all my powers together and sort of scram that this was the moment that it all been leading to, and I couldn't let the side down, you know, and like being about to like holding my ground and having starting my first little sentences with him, and then all of like these women, like Greenham women that were flying with us, and my mum and all the CND friends of hers, and like all just kind of swooping in and being like, quite right, Rebecca, and another thing, and also a shame on you, sir, how dare you pick on the people. You know, so kind of brilliant balance of both not making it feel like me feel like I'd done a bad job, so like protecting my little ego, you know, whilst also being like, you sir are a schmuck. They were always like that, and that was my memory of going to the camp with my mum as well, that the women
what an interesting early sort of experience of sisterhood,
yeah,
at such a young age, just
and motherhood, a group, yeah, group motherhood. It was very like it takes a village. You know, I felt like in one way I had this very intense relationship with my mum, but I also felt like I was in a village of really large women, really, really intense women, being very, you know, supportive of each other. Also having rows sometimes, having intense times, but absolutely had each other's back when there was anything like that.
So did you go with your mum on her first visit to Greenham, or...?
I don't know how. No, I should imagine I probably didn't. I expect she would have gone and sussed out. So my mum did several things at Greenham, and I did some of them with her, but definitely not all of them. So she did, here are the things that I did do with her. So I went and hung out in the day. So if we'd fundraised, or we had a collection of food or something like that, we would take stuff to Greenham. So I would do that. And I think, when I'm not sure, because I don't remember, but what my mum's friends seem to think is they think they probably spent most of their time at Orange Gate. And from the way that I've heard women talk about Orange Gate, I think it was quite child friendly and quite sort of a bit less intense maybe than some of the other bigger gates. Or I don't know. Anyway, I think we went to Orange. And I can remember like hanging around on the verges with women when they were sat with their signs and chatting to them about how people were with them in the cars, and hearing the cars go past and sometimes have a little wave and a like a salute to the green women, and sometimes like shouting nasty stuff out the windows, and me thinking, just wow, this is fascinating, this is grown-ups, this is what the world is going to be like as a grown-up. It's going to be some people who are lovely to you and some people who are horrible to you, all really fast, like this one, in a zooming past you.
So do you remember smells and things from the camp?
I mean, I remember the smell of the fires and like very rudimentary kind of lentily food that I wouldn't have eaten. I'd have been like, no, thank you. It is not for me. Thank you so much. I shall go home and have other food. I more remember the way that the women were, which felt really safe. I felt like I could go up and talk to anybody, which I know is not everyone's experience.
You've kept that, haven't you? The world is your Greenham still.
Yeah, it was really nice because there's so many places that confused people.
Yeah.
Me men found me very confusing as a child because I wasn't rude.
And still, I think.
But I really wasn't in my place. Yeah, and still.
When you go over and go, hello.
Hello, I'm John Knowles.
I'm just about to pull you up on a few things.
Yeah. Did you know that smoking can give you cancer? Have you heard of the Me Too movement? And I was at Greenham, and any kind of CND meeting that my mum's group were at, which would be full of Greenham women and feminists, I would be able to go up and talk to anybody about anything and ask them anything I wanted about the movement, and talk to them as if we were equals, you know, talk to them about the important things we were all doing for the world. So they were very tolerant, is what I'm saying, basically. They were a very tolerant group of people.
Do you remember other children being there when you went?
Yeah, I remember being there with my little friend Christopher, whose mum was a big friend of my mum's. And there's a couple of kids that we used to hang out with and go with, who I think were friends of my mum's group at that time. And I can remember Embrace the Base. So I can remember these kind of quiet times where you might be quite like a few people were around and it was quite laid back. And then I can remember Embrace the Base, which was massive. And I was just like, there were just tons of, but it felt normal again because there were tons of women who brought their kids. Like there were just tons of families. And it was, and I remember that. I remember the singing, like the sound of so many women singing. And I can remember holding hands with my mum on one side and with someone that I didn't know on the other side, like another woman. I don't remember who it was. She might have been a friend of ours, but I don't remember who it was at the time. And just looking up at them. And there was some swaying because I think in some parts of the place they were swaying the fence down. So right. There was a bit of movement. You weren't sort of still and you were swaying with the singing. And I just remember it being this really overwhelmingly powerful for female experience.
Do you remember your mum's face when you looked up at her?
Yeah, I can remember her beaming down at me, just smiling. And she was really elated with the whole thing as well. Yeah. And just beaming down at me. And me, I remember just thinking, my mum is so cool. And women are so cool. And you're a woman, this is brilliant. So that was all very nice. Yeah, that was great.
And how long were you there for? Do you remember how long you stood?
We didn't live in the area that long. We only lived.
Oh, I just meant standing around the base holding hands. How long? Do you remember?
Gosh, no idea. A concept of time at that age. Mm. I just don't. I don't know. I mean, a few hours maybe.
Wow.
But she did loads of really interesting things without me as well, because there were lots of things that she did that I wouldn't have been appropriate for me to be there for. That I remember better than. That's probably about, that's really, I know so little, that's really all I remember of my own stuff. Mm. But stuff that she did night watch. So she would go.
Oh,
the,
right.
Yeah, so she did the whole, like, okay. Sit by the tents and chat and keep them safe. And she also...
Did you do that at a particular gate?
I think, I'm only guessing because her friends have only got a fairly rough guess. But they think Orange. They think they've spent most of their time at Orange. Mm. But she also went off and did a demonstration and got arrested. She sat down in front of Margaret Thatcher's car.
So I remember you telling me this when I was about 19. I was thinking, wow, Becca's mom's cool.
Yeah, she was cool. So there was one thing, she would do stuff in town. So she would do stuff with C&D Group and try, and that would get in the press. And my dad would help organise the press because he was in advertising. Mm. So he's a really stuffy advertising agency. And then at the weekends, he's doing all this Larry. They were like madmen, these guys. They were just like, it was like madmen. And my dad was just like complete outsider. And no wonder we ended up moving to Cornwall having a health food shop. But anyway. But yeah, so there were some things like where we'd be in the paper because they'd made a massive cruise missile and occupied a space in the town centre in the middle of a Saturday. And there'd be a picture of me sitting on it and that would get into the paper or something like that. But then also I think we made a pretend bunker that I was in at one point, and that got in the paper, I think. But I think the thing she got arrested for, I think, was sitting in front of Margaret Thatcher's car when Margaret Thatcher was making a visit to the base, and a load of women sat in front of the car and kept kissing and eventually got arrested, got pulled away and went back and got pulled away and went back and got arrested. And she had, and there was this day of her being in court. So quite often my dad would take a day, not that often, but when like every now and then, my dad would take a day off work because my mum had to go and do some important action. Or because she had her day in court, and he'd be like, I mean, me and him be proudly waiting at home and doing our own thing because mum was in court. And so she had this brilliant day where she, they would have them in there, lots of them in the court at the same time, wouldn't they? And her memories were of things like, she was very proud that when it got to her turn, she wouldn't tell the judge her marital status, or whether she had whether she was supported by a man or not, and whether she was a missus and things. And he was like, but I can't give you the appropriate fine, and you're going to end up basically getting more fine than you think. And she was like, nope, this is not irrelevant. It's not relevant. I'm my own person. You charge me for what you think I've done wrong, not what whether you think I'm attached to a man. I did this off my own volition because I'm an autonomous being. And he was like, that is enough. There's Knowles on the gavel and things like that. So she was really quite sort of like, good at that. And then a bit later on, there'd been lots more women go through, and some were fined and some wouldn't pay their fines. We're going to go to prison, which my mum didn't want to do. She was going to pay her fine, but she had her say and all that stuff. And then somehow a load of women managed to, there was a woman in the group called Blue, and it was her birthday, and a load of women managed to get a lit birthday cake into the court and just suddenly started singing "Happy Birthday to Blue" and all like, and the whole, so of course it's full of other women, other Greenham women and women that have had that, and they're all there together, so they all just go, "Oh, happy birthday to Blue," and it just like the whole thing is like, and the judges are smashing into the gavel, and they managed to do it right when Blue is in the dock, so she's like, "Oh, it's nice, isn't it?"
There's so many stories like that in court, isn't there? There's just so many of them. Sudden singing all together, or humming makes me laugh as well. The way that there was a story of, like, you know, just a collective hum that just went on for ages, and all the judges going, Oh my God. Stop.
Yeah, and I think they were trying to get the cake up to her to blow the candles out, and the judge was like, "God, you remove these women." And I'm like, "Oh, you spoil." It's a birthday, you know. There's lots of that sort of stuff. The other thing I can remember is that sometimes there would be the whole idea of carry Greenham home is you'd go off and do your own versions of things, or sometimes the Greenham women would say, "We really need a couple of women to go and have a presence at this place." And I don't know which one this was, but basically we set up another small peace camp at a different military base, a little one, to call attention to a particular thing that was happening there. And I don't know what it was, but I remember that it was just my mum and me and a couple of other families. So it's really small. And I can remember that really clear. We just turned up with our tents and I guess probably just to get press again, probably. And we were there for the weekend. And I can remember my mum just handling this policeman absolutely amazingly. I remember that when we first got there, he was like really tried to bully her and the other women and was really like snide and a bit lascivious. I remember having a really nasty vibe off him. He was just like a local, like the local plod sort of thing. And I can remember just watching her just like not accept that from him, but not be angry with him either. Just totally it was basically watching someone model assertiveness. She just gave him back all of the sleaze. She didn't flirt with him. She didn't bat her eyelids. She just shut all that down. But she was really pleasant and straightforward and told him what they were going to do and wouldn't move on. And said, "Well, you have to think about whether you want to arrest me, but that, you know, we're only going to be here till here," and blah, blah, blah. And by the end of the weekend, he was like, bringing her cups of tea from the police station and like the whole vibe of like how he was, we were like, had our little community, and he just like facilitated it, having and it was just stuff like watching her do stuff like that, where she could just like, it was like a Jedi mind trick. She was able to do that sort of stuff with people brilliantly with these men, and she definitely learned a lot of that from Greenham, a lot of that. Yeah. she was definitely one of the very struck by the idea that you break down the us and them barrier and make it harder for them, for the soldiers or the police to be horrible to you. Yeah. She was like, it's not going to stop them doing that. You know, the ones that are going to want to do that stuff are going to do it, but it's going to make it more difficult for a lot of the ones that are in the middle, or the kind of, you're trying to find that bit of humanity in as many of them as you can. And she was really, good at that.
As you talk about it, it's really interesting in terms of, when we approached this project and we thought about the radicalization of that generation of women and how it impacted their children. And just when you talk about her, just how much she reminds me of you when you talk about her, like all of those qualities are very much qualities I see in you after, you know, knowing you for how long it is, over 20 years. And it's just so interesting, the emotional legacies that are passed down. It's kind of, what an amazing kind of emotional thing to hand to your child in navigating difficult situations like that, and having self-worth
and just watching someone do that, you know, you have
having a blueprint in
you have to have that kind of behavior modeled. It's really hard to
especially probably from quite a young age in some ways as well, to have it so ingrained.
It was really, I felt very fortunate.
It's an amazing gift, isn't it?
Huge. And just like all those things, you know, having her deconstruct sexist fairy tales with me, to give voice to that thing that when you're reading fairy tales, there's only ever a princess who's pretty and she doesn't do anything and she goes to sleep or whatever.
And if she's bruised by a pea, it's amazing.
Yeah. And you wouldn't even be that. You wouldn't even be allowed to do that in the story because you're not pretty. So do you know what I mean? Or it's like all that stuff. And she would like give voice to that and how boring and disappointing that was, and then go and find me better stories and spend like loads of time coming up with brilliant stories from around the world that centered active women. And she was just, because she was in that place and ahead of that curve for herself, she was able to do all that stuff with me when I was tiny. Mm. You spend years trying to dress for yourself, don't you, find those women?
Years and years.
And I was really fortunate about that, really fortunate.
I feel very fortunate to have met you when I was 19, and had a lot of that. I mean, I think my mom was very feminist in her own way as well, I think, in many ways. But that was a kind of very sort of, I don't know, it was just very direct, your feminism. And it came, I think, came through you and came to me. I feel very touched by it too. Yeah.
And that's very Greenham as well, though, because I think that my mum was probably, like your mum, she probably was, her heart was probably leaning towards a left wing or feminist analysis, but it wasn't until she got to Greenham and heard all of the ways that can intersect, all of the options, was hearing people talk about, you know, because it kind of fast forwarded her politically, because she was hearing about how race and sex and sexuality and disability and all these will all impact on, you know, all the stuff around, you know, feminism and disadvantage and patriarchy and control. And then she was also having all the other stuff they do at Greenham, which is create their own music, find Dianic worship sites, find stories from around the globe where women have been excluded. Like, oh, but did you know about this goddess? And did you know about this story? Did you know about that fairy tale? You know, and like, there's this melding pot of here's all the other options. So I think that she then had that to give me, and then I had it to give it to anyone else.
Yeah.
And that's what you and I both want from the project for around Greenham, or anything around Greenham, isn't it? We want to hand that on to someone else who didn't get that from, basically indirectly, from my mum.
Yes. And I remember at her funeral as well, just how many people were there, and so many of those sort of stories of being touched through her feminism, her sort of, and her contentment, I think, as well, her contentment and sort of steadiness in herself was something I think that came up a bit in that.
And her compassion. She's she never ran out. She ran out of energy. She was tired quite often, and she found other people quite draining. She wasn't like me. She didn't get energy from other people. She got quite drained, but she never, ever ran out of compassion and sympathy. And she always had just that in spades. And it just meant that people got a lot of her when they were around her. And so, like you said, that funeral, so just people who had even met her a few times just saying, she just analysed my dream with me once when I came to your house, and it changed how I thought about like myself forever, you know. She didn't even tell me anything, she just let me talk it through and just like watching it. And I was like, oh my god. So like, people had these like profound experiences with her. And it definitely was a link between feminism and compassion and a brave sternness.
Did she talk about Greenham much in later life?
Yeah, she did. She was really proud of it. And I think she felt like she kind of missed out when she moved away. I think she would have liked to have moved to, I think she, we moved right at the zenith of her involvement and her politicalization. And I think that, I don't know, me and my dad talk about it sometimes as something that might have been not the best timing for her, actually. Mm-hmm. I think she missed out on a lot of that and a lot of community, a lot of sisterhood. She left nearly all her friends there. And I think that actually, that was quite sad. I think that was a real shame. And then when I do remember that a friend of mine, a lovely friend, talked about, was a journalist for The Observer, and she wanted to get a cross-section of very different people to do, I think it was to review, to do reviews at the end of a year. It was like a sort of best things you've come across this year kind of thing. And some of them were kind of famous people, and some of them were just like quirky, interesting people. And she had a similar feeling about you about my mum as well, how she knew her and admired her. And said, would your mum be one of the women that is in this interview? I think she ended up being one of the only middle-aged women in the interview. And so she was in this big double page spread, you know, and was really proud of that, and talked about Greenham and politics in that. And had that as part of her, why she liked a particular thing or whatever. And just, you know, it really definitely did sort of help to define her, I think.
Sorry, did she stay involved with CND? in her new living?
Well, she didn't so much when she got there. I think she tried, but it was a much, it's a very different attitude. It's a very different sort of mood in Cornwall. People do things differently, and she just didn't quite get into the zeitgeist of it. But she also, the main thing really probably is that she got pregnant with my brother almost as soon as she got down here, and they had wanted another child, but they hadn't expected to have another child, and then it suddenly was all happening. And she was much older by then. There's nearly 10 years between me and my brother. Mm. And so she was an older, not particularly old, but an older mum. And she was very, again, very excited to be pregnant, very focused on being the best pregnant person and the best mum and all that sort of stuff. And then she just really was like a 24/7 mum for the next nearly decade. And then kind of came back out of that and was like, oh, I might be a relate counsellor now or whatever. And sort of then picked up her life. And by then, that's why that story about her going on that march and being like, oh no, we're not doing the Lord's Prayer, that really stands out, because there was like 2 years of intense Greenham, then 10 years of intense being a mum to me and my little brother, who was quite an anxious child. You wouldn't think it now, he's very confident, but at the time, very anxious child. And this just sort of was in the middle of there somewhere, and she hadn't been doing that kind of stuff when that happened. Although she was, you know, she got more involved again when she felt like Dickon had got his little sea legs, as it were, for life. Then she was able to come out and do some more other stuff, not just mumming, although it wasn't just, because she was brilliant at it and that's what she wanted to do. And she felt that was a feminist choice. She should be allowed to choose what she wanted to do, and that was her choice. She wanted to be a mum.
Yeah.
And then
I had a question then. Now I've completely forgotten it. Oh yeah, that was a very important question. And what do you think your mum would think about all the work that we're doing with the women, and just how many women have been in touch, and how vast the archive has become, and
I think she would, a part of me, mostly I think she would love it. I think she'd be delighted. And I think she would have loved to be interviewed for it and have her be on there. And we'd have had our lovely photographer take a photo of her, and she'd have loved that, because like everyone has always says, and like everyone we photograph said, oh, I look terrible if I hate photographs, but you know, whatever, we'll see it. And then they'd have this photo done by wonderful Christine, and they'd go, oh my God, it's lovely. And that's how I always wanted to look in a photo.
I know, it really seems to, all those photographs really seem to have captured an essence that is just so magical somewhere.
Yeah, because it's not only like you look at it and you think, yes, that is that person, but they also look at it and go, oh, I like the look of that, which never happens, does it?
Yeah.
It's never Christine Bradshaw. But so I think my mum would have loved all that. There's a tiny part of me that worries she might have been like, a bit like, I worry that the Greenham woman might be like, why are you doing this thing that isn't your thing, it's our thing? So I worry a bit about that, because that's fair. You know, there's a fine line between celebrating and appropriating, isn't there? There's a fine line between sharing and changing what you're sharing, because it's coming through you as a filter, and trying to be a conduit rather than a creator, in a way, I suppose. But I think overall, she definitely would have been pleased that the access that other women would have to this. She was a really passionate believer in women-only space. She was like, you really need that sometimes, and women don't realise that they need it until they have it, and then they go, oh, it changes everything. Yeah. You need to be there all the time even, but you need access to it.
Yeah.
So I think she'd have been really pleased with that. And she would have really liked the messages about, she wanted people to be more compassionate. She was very, very loving, and she really cared about that. And I was going to sort of, this isn't really about her, but my having that relationship with her allowed me to have other relationships with, and not going to school, I think, as well. I had friends of all different ages, and I always carried on having friends of all different ages. And when I first went to London after I'd done university and drama school and things, when I met the lovely you, I joined CND, and I actually got elected onto the national committee, and did like, because they had a resurgence because of the Iraq war. So I was doing stuff with them as a representative on the Stop the War committees and things like that. And I met a woman who had the same kind of thing as mine. She was called Sue Davis, and she was, I think, nearly 80 when I met her. And she had been to Greenham in a visitor capacity like my mum, and had all these great stories. And she was really good at being like, just really integrally herself, really kind, but also really good at that thing where you go, oh no, we won't be doing that, but we will try this, or breaking down that us and them thing. And she, so we used to visit her and hang out with her, and I had lovely stories from her, but she had this great experience where she talked to me about, she'd been at Greenham, and she'd been sort of just chatting to a woman near the fence, and a policeman had come up to her and said, "I'm sorry, would you mind, if you don't mind, would you give me one of those CND badges?" And she was like, yes, I've got a CND badge somewhere. And it turned out that he had a 17-year-old daughter at home. And he said, she hates me. She hates my job. She hates the military. We're having a horrible time at home. And I just thought, if I could maybe bring her a CND badge from one of the actual Greenham women, that she would, she might look on me, but I might get a few brownie points because she thinks you're heroes and that I'm absolute scum. And so Snudo's good giving him this CND badge through the fence, you know. And that's the kind of thing that I feel like, I think I told my mum about that, that she'd have really, that's the kind of thing that she really approved of, and that those kind of moments were kind of important to those women, which was really lovely. Because you needed both. You needed people like that to do some of that stuff, to make some of those men question those things. And you also needed women who would put up with absolutely no shits and no fucks given, because they were also, you know, they were giving those guys porn in the lorries before they made them drag the women away. They were geeing them up to hate women. You need women to be tough with the men that weren't nice and this. So you needed your Helen Johns and things as well, you know.
And you met Helen, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did meet her. She was also she kind of was her people like her and Sue Davis were really excited and Pat Arrowsmith. They were all sort of still, they were all doing the stuff with CND, and they were really excited that this new batch of like young, energetic people they could boss around and actually get to do things, because lots of C&D were quite old by the time the Iraq war was coming around. So there's some of this influx of young people who were all like, you know, passionately against this war as well, and they were like, these older people were like, brilliant, and they knew exactly what to do with us. And so I went to one action with Helen that was up in Menwith. Went to Menwith Hill with her, and it was just, I mean, I was just so, she was so brilliant and hardy. She'd called this in December. It seemed like, you know, Yorkshire in December in the middle of nowhere. And we were freezing. And I was just so rubbish at like I don't think I'd have been a very good Greenham woman at all. Like, I can remember them like calling us to go and have food.
You do have a bit of a penchant for champagne.
I was like, oh no, thank you, I'm all right for lentil broth, because I was in my tent eating my Marks and Spencers, you know, things that I bought with me, because I could remember from my childhood how bad the food would be. So it was like, it was in there scoffing stuffed vine leaves.
But then you look at the stuff that was going on, though. You look at those flyers and you think the I think that we sort of imagine that in the world where, I mean, it still is a massive issue, of course, but I think that it was just so at the forefront then that I just don't know if, I don't know, I like to think that I hope I would have gone, even though I would have been a bit hopeless. Yeah. Well, everyone would have wished I wasn't there. Like, could she go now? She's really not helping.
But the Greenham women are very generous about that, the women that actually lived there, aren't they? They sort of say, you know, it ran so well because so many women supported it. Like, we needed the women that weren't living there to bring us food and bring us clothes, bring us Gore-Tex. And, you know, like, they can be very generous about how it was a symbiotic system that needed everyone to play the different parts they played.
Absolutely. And the Green Woman Everywhere book, the Alice Cook and Gwyn Kirk book, like, there's so many dreams and things accounted in that, like dreams of women who were so terrified of nuclear. And I just kind of think it was just so frightening. Like, I don't know. I mean, I just can totally see why people went there in their droves, you know.
I can totally remember saying to my mum and dad being like, not trying to scaremonger me, but being honest about why they were doing these things. Because it was things that were going to possibly involve my mum being arrested or hurt by the police and things. Those were real concerns. And we were making big life choices in this. And I can totally remember, you know, the idea that there was a weapon that could destroy it. And them saying to me, it's almost certainly not going to happen, but we want to be part of saying, you know, that we don't believe that it should even be, they should even exist. And I was like, yes, definitely. Let's definitely make sure that doesn't happen. But I can remember like having like them doing what was comforting to me at the time, which was like, I was like, if there's going to be a nuclear war, can we kill ourselves? And they were like, Yes, okay. And we'd be like, so we'll just take like some sleeping tablets and we'll cuddle up on the bed and we'll just die at the same time, won't we? And my mum and dad would be like, yeah. And obviously like that, no, that's just not, that isn't a magic pill that will allow you all to clock out at the center. And I was like, and I can lie in the middle and we'll just, and we won't have all of the horrible, like, I mean, I'd read this Raymond Briggs book by then. So then we won't have all our hair falling out. We won't go one at a time and no one will suffer. We'll just get it done before. Because we know what will happen, don't we? And we just want to get it done. And they were like, yes, we'll do that. But it's not going to happen. We're all going to live a really long time. It's all going to be fine.
And actually, women were having dreams like, oh, you know, walking through barren landscapes, like just desperate to find someone that they could die with. You know, that those kind of horrific, frightening kind of dreams that, you know, terrifying.
I can remember my 7th birthday like doing that, like being we were, for some reason we weren't at my house, we were at a friend's house in the movement, and I knew my presents were in this wardrobe, but I just couldn't sleep, and it was next day as my birthday, and I remember getting up and being like, mom, it's gone sleep at all, and I'd be like, okay, you can get one present, why don't you get a sort of present that might feel a bit like a book, and then you can stay awake and read for a while, and then finally get. And I was like, thank you. So I went into this bag and got like a present that felt like a book, and was like, right, birthday, read all night, and then we'll have birthday. And I, and then this book was about, it was a book, a children's book about Hiroshima, told from the point of view of a little girl who does manage to more or less survive. Although, you know, almost everyone she knows dies horribly. And there was graphic pictures of her wandering through that landscape with these awful things happening. And then actually, you know, at the end, she, you know, it's lucky because her mum does survive and look after her, because she never grew up and her mum spent the rest of her life taking shards of glass out of her head and she never got any older. And I was just like,
what? Happy birthday.
I remember this being like, that's not birthday-ish at all. And having to go back downstairs and be like in like floods and being like, and my mum having just a moment of like looking around the room at her friends being like, who's got her this for her birthday? Like, I don't think she needs more of that. Her consciousness is raised. I don't think that was necessary. There were little moments like that where they were a bit harrowing, but my mum was very good at holding that and letting you have that emotion, and being honest with you, being like, but we, you know, we're doing stuff about it, and we are together, and we're okay, and that's not what the whole world is. This is just one concern, and people in charge of things are always going to make decisions we don't like, and we always have to argue with them and move things in a better direction. She was really good about all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious. I could just,
you can't shield your kids from everything, can you? You can't shield your kids from every nutter.
No. What? That was so lovely. Those memories are so special. I'm so glad that we got to do this. Did you want to add anything else about anything that we've missed in making tribute?
No, I think that probably is, I don't know, it's hard, isn't it? Because it's my mum and you don't want to sort of draw a line under the fabulousness of her life, but then equally, like, only I'm going to feel that, because she's only me and my brother will listen to the interview and want to hear more. Everyone else will be like, now that's kind of an angsty type. So yeah, she sounds great, but you know, draw a line. the woman who actually lived there, maybe.
Oh, she was really wonderful, and there's a real kind of spirit in. I'm looking at you in your childhood bedroom now, which is a really lovely place to.
That she actually redecorated when I moved out. So you're looking at her re-feathering the nest in order to bring me back.
The beautiful dandelions. Are they dandelions on the wall?
They are sort of sunflowery type thing on blue, aren't they? She loved
beautiful,
blue.
Beautiful, breezy, blue. Lovely. Oh, well, thank you to Marie for everything, really.
Thank you. For
a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, good work, Mum. And yeah, thank you. This has been lovely. It's really nice to know she's up there, even though she can't be up there herself. We've kind of got some representation of her, hopefully.
Yeah.